phantom. My heart skips eight beats at once. If we were meant to be, we would have been by now. See what you wanna see, but all I see is him right now. Watch my heart burn with the fire that you started in me, but I'll never let you back to put it out.
Good evening, everyone. This is Izzy Borshoff, and you're listening to 91.5 FM Tufts Freeform Radio. So I'm filling in for The Family Show today, and I'm kind of bringing a bit of my normal show in your 20s to the 11 p.m. slot. So with me, I have a guest co-interviewer, Isabel Patkovsky, and an interviewee, Patrick Burke. So Patrick's joining us from the far-flung lands of the UK, where he's a junior doctor, and he's kindly agreed to stay up late and come on our show today to talk about finding a moral compass in your 20s. So we might just jump right in, if that works for you, Patrick.
That works for me, yep.
Okay, so I was kind of interested in talking to you about this topic because we got chatting before, and I think you grew up in a reasonably religious environment, is my understanding, and your perspectives on that have kind of shifted a little bit. So can you talk a bit about your first kind of experiences with religion and moral frameworks and how those might have been connected?
I can indeed, yeah. So yeah, that's right. I was born and raised in Belfast, which, as you may know, is a reasonably religious place to be from. And my family are quite firm in their Christian views. So my granddad was a minister in a Presbyterian church. I've been to a Presbyterian church all my child life, and the religious views really did form a really big part of my upbringing, both in family and in kind of just being in Belfast around school. About half the people there were Christians. There's a big scripture union. Kind of a lot of my social life as well was formed from people through churches and a lot of my friends were from church. So I think the whole backdrop of my growing up was very much in the framework of Christianity, and particularly, I guess, like Presbyterian and Protestantism. So that's kind of where I came from.
And do you remember, just to jump in for a minute, do you remember your parents ever kind of questioning how they would raise you, whether they would raise you kind of in the church, or was it just kind of a given that this was how you guys lived your life and it was how your community kind of lived your life?
I think it was very much a given. I think that there wasn't much of an attitude of debate or of talking through issues or discussing ethics. So I think the at least the way that I felt was a given, that the Christian and Protestant viewpoint was it. There was no real alternative to speak of. It didn't seem like there was much of a
right. And potentially exposing my ignorance here, but what do you think were kind of the key tenets of that for you? What were the focus of those kind of dictates, for want of a better word, if it wasn't something that you all kind of explored more philosophically?
Yeah. So I guess I need to like differentiate between what I took from it and what my parents or the church tried to convey. I think there was when looking back, what I recall most strongly is a kind of very firm hierarchy of what's important. So there's this a model that I do remember being taught of, and then reiterated again and again and again, that at the top, the most important thing is God and your relationship with Him, and acting in accordance with what would be best in His eyes. The second would be other people, and the third would be yourself. So it's a kind of
a hierarchy,
of
priorities.
Of priorities or values. And the other thing that strikes me that I took from it, which I guess is reasonably central to the theology, is that in the context of having an afterlife, of assuming that you're a soul that will endure past death, this 80 years, or if you're lucky, I guess, is completely insignificant, to the point of being of having almost no relative importance whatsoever in the context of your life, which your true life, which would go far beyond. So there's the idea of disobeying or going against what would be in line with Christianity and with what God would want wouldn't make any sense, because there's so much, the afterlife will go on forever, that these 80 years...
You endure the consequences for so long.
Yeah.
I'm interested if you found that comforting as a kid or as a teenager, this idea that life was really insignificant, because for me, I can kind of imagine that swinging either way. You could kind of be overwhelmed by angst in terms of your role, given that it's your period here is so insignificant. But maybe that's what religion does, it kind of alleviates that angst by providing you with a longer term meaning.
I think it's very tricky to know, and it's I think it both like, it's difficult to recall. I think there were periods of immense fear and you know, and insecurity, but there was definitely also a sense of firm purpose, of comfort in knowing, in waking up and knowing what was important and what wasn't, and having a kind a set framework from which to live your whole life. I remember I do remember waking up and, you know, and reading my Bible or reading, you know, what, you know, whatever I've been given by the, you know, the in the youth group or whatever to read that week, and just finding it so rich with meaning and so meaningful, and kind of being able to really just kind of, if any disruption happened in the day or I felt sad or you know, whatever, it kind of did fall away into insignificance in the context of having this, well, it's, you know, it's okay to feel sad or that this thing didn't happen which I wanted, because in the end of the day, this isn't actually very important, because I know what I'm about, and I know that the most important thing is to try and be a good Christian. So I think looking back at the experience at the time, I think I found it more comforting than I did. At least I remember those times more than I do the times of being fearful.
Right, okay. So you enjoyed going to church and going to your youth group?
Yep, definitely. Yep. I really enjoyed. I ended up on for 4 years or so during my teens, when I was getting more and more into it, going to like my parents' church, but also then going to another church beforehand. So I'd get up reasonably early, like, you know, 7, and go to, you know, an 8 till 10 service. Then my parents would pick me up on the way to their church service, and I'll go to theirs, and I'll probably go to church service in the evening. Find a big sense of meaning and then during the week going to youth groups and bits and bobs, and like I did really get involved in the whole thing, in the community, in the content, in the like the worship, in the all the different things going on in the church. You know, I loved it at the time.
And so when did it kind of start to unravel a bit for you?
I'm not sure when it started to unravel. I think the end of school, so the ages 16, 17, 18, I think the doubts over certain aspects of it, of the whole, I guess, Christian package started to creep in. And I think it was a very slow cumulative process of just being exposed to other ideas. And I think it's things like, you know, I think Richard Dawkins published his book, The God Delusion, around that time, which I read. I remember Darren Brown, who's an author in the UK, and published a book around that time talking about his experiences of growing up Christian, and I think it was just an alternative worldview hadn't occurred to me as until those ages, 16, 17, 18. And
so that's interesting to me, just to jump in there, because not many 16-year-olds were picking up the God Delusion, and I can't imagine that many people for whom that kind of book would completely shake your worldview would have voluntarily picked it up. So was there a kind of impetus for you to start engaging with those other ideas, or?
I can't recall. I can't place one.
You were just curious.
No one came into my life. I didn't meet anyone new. I was still in Belfast. I think it was, you know, I quite like my science books, and I think I know that Richard Dawkins wrote another book, The Selfish Gene, which was one of my like favorite science books, so I think I just kind of I probably admired him, and then admired his mind, and then had heard, and I think there was a lot of talk, you know, about it in like, oh, this book, this, you know, do we read it, do we not, do we, you know, is it a bad thing as a Christian to read criticism, and, you know, and
do you know if other people from your church or your youth group read it? Did you discuss it with people?
Yeah, I did. I think there was a lot of my friends from that time I'm still very, very close to, and almost all of us are no longer Christian, and we organize, so this is like even outside of the, you know, the church youth group, but among ourselves in school we would meet up once every other week and discuss Christianity and like how to live a good life. And like, it was
in the schoolyard.
No, not like, so this is like, we'd go around houses every couple of weeks, and we would, I can't remember what we called ourselves. I'll tell you if I remember. But we would meet up and discuss, like, you know, just like, you know, what I guess like our feelings and Christianity and you know, what's the most important things that we think in life, and we take turns leading it, and like, you know, trying to prepare a kind of, you know, I guess like a talk and a discussion with each other. And I think we kind of within that maybe start like derailed each other off the Christian path. I think just like I don't know who it was, you know, but all of us have seemingly gone on a similar journey from being quite devoted to Christianity to like, I don't know if all of us would say we're, you know, what they would say if they're agnostic or atheist or, you know, semi-Christian. I don't know where they would place themselves on the spectrum, but we're, none of us go to church anymore. You know, I think we all have kind of have changed our beliefs in a bizarrely similar way.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me. And I'm wondering, was it moral positions that the church took on particular social issues that bred a disillusionment, or was it sort of more fundamental questions about the kind of evidence or proof or social purpose that might have led to the kind of religion that you guys were observing that caused you to become more disillusioned with it?
I think for me, I think I'm like a reasonably scientific minded person, and I think it was the inconsistencies within the kind of the worldview that it gave. So things like why would a belief in a God be the criteria for admission to, you know, eternity of pleasure rather than eternity to hell? So if, you know, what about someone, you know, who had lived in, you know, wherever far-flung place, you know, and had a different religious view and was never exposed to Christianity, would they then, like,
it didn't make sense to you.
It just didn't make sense at all. And I think it was niggling questions like, more like that. I think the I think it was, yeah, it was I think it was more the inconsistencies of it, the kind of the how it just didn't seem, when you kind of step back, a kind of feasible that it was, you know, the ultimate truth, because it just didn't hang together. I think the social, you know, the potential, you know, implications for social issues kind of maybe came a bit later, and possibly were the, you know,
the clincher.
Yeah, nail in the coffin for my Christian beliefs.
Yeah, and did you discuss that with your parents? Because your parents are both medical and presumably have scientific training, a lot of people who believe in religion, so it's by no means kind of a one way or the other situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you talk about it with them?
No. And almost to this day, I haven't.
Right.
And I think it's probably not entirely fair on them, because I think they initially, like, from within the framework of Christianity, I think if that is your worldview, and that to know... you know, that to know that your son will go to hell forever because he doesn't believe the correct things is kind of what I would be imposing on my parents by discussing these things. So it was just it just didn't seem worth it. It seemed like a huge emotional burden. I'm thinking particularly my mum to put on them. So
you feel like it's better just to leave it undiscussed.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But I think yes, that was that's the avenue I went down. Looking back, like I didn't give enough credit to my parents for kind of having, open enough, like, you know, views to have like proper and fruitful discussions of like the, you know, perceived inconsistencies of it. And actually now both my parents have left that church and are both Quakers. They've converted, I guess I don't know how radical conversion that is, but in the last 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
So I like, and that, I don't know if you know much, is much lesser emphasis on beliefs and on doctrine and on going to heaven and hell. Like it's much the kind of more spiritual being in touch with, you know, whatever there is in this world and that is sacred is kind of the emphasis of that. And, you know, so perhaps they were going through a similar, you know, crisis.
Sort of internal debate, yeah.
And they've ended up going for that route. But still, I to this day, I'm still find it very difficult to discuss these kind of things
with them. Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's completely understandable.
But do you think that they know that you're not religious?
Yeah, no, oh yeah, no, yeah, they do. It's like, it's almost like, yeah, the... I think when we... When these kind of conversations arise, I tend to just avoid the topic, and I'm reasonably happy to speak about, you know, God in kind of abstract terms to, you know, to signify, you know, the wonder of creation, like the not creation of existence, and the like the, you know, the kind of the awe that you experience at this contemplating what it, you know, what it means to be alive and kind of you know or as a kind of, you know, as another word or for you know, a deep sense of love and that kind of thing. So I kind of do, you know,
kind you of, can engage with them on yeah. the issues without kind of talking substance yeah. about the text.
Yeah, I think that's possibly a good way of putting it. Do they? So they are very, very aware that I don't go to church. Yeah. Like they and that my views have differed, have evolved greatly since when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
How did it feel? When was there kind of a moment where you were like, "Oh dear." Everything I ever believed in is no longer, or was it kind of a gradual realization until you one day sort of realized you were, I don't know, not who you thought you might have been?
Yeah, I think there was absolutely not a moment whatsoever. I think it was a very gradual change, and I think I've been. I find it very difficult to know to like, you know, if it, I think coming to terms with the loss of Christianity and the change in my worldview, I've been very, very like very, very slow to come to terms with and to realize and to chew through. I think that kind of avoidance of talking about it I think that of with my parents, I think it probably extends to other. To I think that that whole finding your stance and trying to like work out what is most important to you, I've just found that so, in the absence of that Christian framework, I find it so difficult to come to terms with and to speak about and to put into words, and to that I think it's taken years and years and years to I guess find some words to be able to talk about it and to understand it within myself and to see and to kind of, you know, I guess rebuild a worldview that works for me, or to rediscover.
Yeah. So this is also fascinating because I feel like I grew up in a very secular environment with kind of no guiding religious frameworks. I remember once my grandmother, who wasn't even religious, bought me like a kid's Bible. Yeah. I think it was even like Australian themed. I feel like there were kangaroos in it or something. But I had this sudden moment of like, oh, whoops, was this something I was supposed to be like engaging with the whole time? But that was kind of a fleeting thought, and the book went back on the shelf, and then kind of nothing else came of it. But I imagine that we probably would come to pretty similar conclusions, even at that point in our life, at age 14, 15, about what the right thing to do was in a range of circumstances. So, like, I imagine basically that a lot of what you, a lot of the tenets that you embrace from Christianity about how to live a good life and how to be good, you can find through kind of a sort of logic and reason, and also kind of a rational approach to life. So I think there's some argument that humans will behave morally because we live in a society that requires cooperation, and if you do bad things onto others, then you might be ostracized from the group, and you're kind of deprived of group protection. So I think there are kind of like all these different ways, whether it's like a biological drive or your own reason and logic, that you can come to some of the same lessons or behavioral guides that religion brings you to. So did you think about anything in that way, or why do you think it's so hard when someone loses a religious framework to kind of embrace a different one?
I don't know if it's necessarily the problem for anyone who I think in my personal experience, for the first, you know, very large chunk of my life, I wasn't good at it, or if I wasn't encouraged to do it, or because I was so used to being fed my ethics that I didn't engage that kind of part of my brain to reason through, you know, what it meant to live a moral life or what it meant for something to be good or wrong. It just that notion that you know, it wasn't an absolute, that it wasn't, you know, that it's something that you could rationalize through and think about, just didn't occur. And I think when the framework of kind of, you know, it is good because God says so, when that's taken away, for me, I found it very difficult to find a hook in which to say that this is good and that is bad. The things just felt very meaningless,
it was hard to find something to anchor on.
I'm getting slightly better at kind of that rational, you know, like I think there is some kind of emergence of kind of, you know, comfort in following, you know, what feels right and what you can rationalize through and kind of discover, you know, of through introspection and through knowing yourself and following like how you feel. But that's like, you know, it has definitely taken a long time to even start to be able to to kind of, you know, to have a kind of
coherent
yeah. moral like kind of compass.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well now that I've dragged you through your your past this late at night, we might take a break for a song. I'm going to put on Rex Orange County's cover of Randy Newman's You've Got a Friend in Me. You might remember it from Toy Story. So we'll come back after this for maybe a bit of a discussion around what you believe in now and where you found that hook, and also for a public service announcement from Isabel.
Got a friend in me.
You got a friend in me.
When the road looks rough ahead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed,
you just remember what your old past said. Boy, you've got a friend in me.
Yeah, you got a friend in me.
Got a friend in me.
You got a friend in me.
You got troubles, I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you.
We stick together and see it through, 'cause you got a friend in me.
Yeah, you got a friend in me.
And some of the folks might be a little smarter than I am, bigger and stronger too, maybe.
But none of them will ever love you the way I do. It's me and you, boy.
And as the years go by,
our friendship will never die.
You're gonna see it's our destiny.
Friend in me.
You got a friend in me.
You got a friend in me.
You got a friend in me.
This is 91.FM. At 91.5 FM, sorry, WMFO Medford. It's Izzy Borshoff here. We're doing a little run of my show In Your 20s tonight. So the premise of the show is that we, or I, talk to different people about a different facet of life in your 20s, be it sort of race, religion, dating, really whatever. People have lots of interesting experiences to share. So usually I do this on a Tuesday from 5 to 6 every other week, but we're doing a little bit later than usual tonight because I'm filling in for the family show. But let's get back to it. We'll kick off the second half with a PSA from Isabel. What's our PSA tonight?
Numbers to think about, PSA. Some numbers to think about. The United States has less than 5% of the planet's population, but incarcerates 24% of its prisoners and accounts for 43% of the world's total military spending. A public service message from WMFO and Medford Tufts Educational Radio.
Oh.
That is interesting.
That is interesting and somewhat disturbing. Thank you, Isabel.
Of course.
Okay, so we might get back into things on that cheery note. you'll be glad you're going back to the UK, where a presumably less significant proportion of the population is incarcerated. So we kind of touched on the crisis point and the confronting the moral void,
yeah,
of losing your religion. So what do you believe in now?
I feel this is probably the more appropriate part of the conversation for the Indian 20s, because I think what we spoke about for the last while was kind of setting the stage, because it was all mainly in my teenage years. I think the and it's kind of been, I think my 20s have been, I've quite enjoyed this project of kind of starting to figure out what I might believe in, and to kind of to realize what might matter to me. So for my main, so what I guess the when I was in my early 20s, I was still very, very much feeling the void and feeling very, very lost for meaning, and led to some problems with my mental health. And the one of the things that was suggested to me, and I think it was actually from my dad, was a mindfulness book called Wherever You Go, There You Are by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And I read through that, and it did strike a note with me. It's difficult to pinpoint what, but it's something about the message of accepting yourself and of leading a good life, and kind of providing some kind of way of thinking about things that seemed coherent and seemed consistent and didn't kind of have much mumbo jumbo in it. There's nothing to take, you know, to accept before you can, you know, before you can start, you know, this practice of mindfulness. So I got a bit into that, and then I did a the Jon Kabat-Zinn has a kind of 8-week course of learning mindfulness that you practice for about 45 minutes a day, this kind of mindfulness meditation technique, and you read his book alongside that. And I think I started to feel a bit better in myself doing it. So and through my university, through like the years of university, I relied on these techniques, on this mindfulness meditation, to kind of help my mental health and help me feel better, kind of as a, you know, as kind of a therapeutic means.
So was it more a way of, yeah, kind of maintaining mental health and assuaging anxiety around the moral void,
yes,
than actually acting as a sort of behavioural guide in the way that religion might have? And did you still grapple with that question, or was it once you were feeling more comfortable with yourself and letting things unfold, the questions of how to live and how to behave, you could kind of more easily address just through your own moral compass?
Yeah, I think very much the latter, that the, I think I was much, much too busy feeling overwhelmed with my feelings and with trying to get through the university degree to productively grapple with questions of finding a moral compass. I think, so it was very much a therapeutic, you know, thing that I was doing, that I was trying to kind of get through, you know, the years the years at university at that time. Since then, and more increasingly in the last few years, and from when I took a break in the middle of my studies because I was feeling quite overwhelmed, and I travelled for a year, and I think then I started to grapple a bit more with the kind of with finding a kind of, you know, a framework that I could, you know, I guess we spoke about that hook to, like, you know, to something to differentiate what's good and what's bad, when the kind of framework that I had grown up with had kind of gone away, and I struggled to find something else. And I guess the kind of more religious, the more ethical and you know, moral questions that come along with religion, I started to ask and read about, and I think from the a lot of the, you know, as you may know, a lot of the mindfulness practices come from Buddhism, and the kind of, you know, the mindfulness, you know, that's one aspect of Buddhism, but then the ethical conduct is kind of, you know, it kind of comes hand in hand. And when you start, when having been introduced to the kind of the practice of mindfulness, and then going to try, you know, just out of interest to read what the Buddhist ideas and what the good life is, it kind of seemed to all come together somewhat to as a, oh, this is actually quite a coherent and you know, rich way to understand how to live a life, and you know, and kind of a way of considering what might be good and what might be bad.
So did you start reading about Buddhism after you'd done the 8-week course, the mindfulness course, or did that come about a little bit later?
I came about a little bit later. That was like when I took that year out, so I had more time to think and to dwell and to, and you know, as you,
this was the hitchhiking year, right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Do you want to just briefly explain what you did and maybe what the impetus was for doing it?
I think the impetus was probably was feeling a bit lost and overwhelmed with life, you know, see previous conversation, and I just wanted a break. I wanted to kind of try and figure stuff out, and I left home and just traveled for a year by hitchhiking, pretty unstructured, just hitchhiking east until I got to China. And I made this, and I kind of, you know, made a blog that you know, to you know, connect with my friends back home from Belfast to Beijing. And I just kind of slowly made my way across and kind of, you know, I just kind of chatted with people as I went along, and kind of like, you know, it was a really nice opportunity to kind of try and, you know, encounter, you know, various world views that, you know, I perhaps didn't so much coming up in a reasonably, you know, conservative background, and to kind of explore different areas of thought. And in there, you know, the a lot of, you know, people were talking about mindfulness meditation and different courses they had been on, and recommending different books on Buddhism and things that around that time that I read. Yeah, that was probably the time that I started to actually be introduced to the, you know, the wider concepts within Buddhism.
Yeah, I have a question about that, because I had always thought of that trip as being because you weren't really wanting to do medicine and really needing a year out from knowing that you were halfway through this really long degree that you didn't really want to be doing.
Yeah.
But that's not, like, the way you've told it this time, yeah, it sounds like that's actually nothing to do with it.
I think not feeling lost and kind of not wanting to do medicine and having lost a kind of framework from which I interpreted life goes very, very hand in hand.
Yeah.
I think I found it very difficult to pin down at that time what I was struggling with, and kind of not really enjoying the course of medicine was definitely a part of it, but I think it was kind of a smaller part in the bigger, just kind of not really knowing what I liked or what was important to me in life, just kind of in general. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. It's just interesting to me because it's like, also, like, everyone in your family is a doctor,
yeah,
and everyone in your family is a Christian, so
yeah,
it's like there's something,
crisis of identity
kind of connected there. Yeah.
But you felt like the trip sort of served its purpose. Like you had time, you read, you came to maybe some more comfort.
Perhaps.
Or do you think all those questions are still up in the air? I mean, all of us are kind of grappling with the meaning of life on a daily basis, I think.
I think it was good for me. I was healthy and I enjoyed it a lot of the time. I didn't really come to any firm conclusions coming back. And when I was kind of came back to university and, you know, the meaning void was still waiting for me when I came back. And I think I did very much like still struggle with those questions. I think the difference maybe in that second, you know, having done that, was I kind of had this, like, at least an inkling that there was another, you know, there could be another way to see life that could be meaningful as well, in the way that going to church, you know, three times on a Sunday and going to various youth groups to kind of infuse life with meaning, you know, I had kind of had a feeling that there was another way that, you know, I could live a meaningful life. But I hadn't, you know, I didn't, I hadn't, you know, I hadn't really...
Didn't come back and it was all worked out.
No.
Yeah.
So
this is another point of comparison, your comment about going to church three times on a Sunday and then becoming more interested in Buddhism. So... I think it's really fashionable today as a kind of Gen Y atheist or agnostic to say, you know, I don't really like the idea of institutionalized religion, but the community aspect is really important and we've really lost our sense of community and I just wish I could have that but without the baggage of the religion. And I think people are finding, I think there are multiple symptoms of people searching for community in a way that might replace religion, and especially young people doing that. I'm interested in the fact that the Buddhism mindfulness route seems to me quite, and correct me if I'm wrong, quite a solitary pursuit. So it doesn't sort of engage with a lot of those popular criticisms of secular society that we maybe lack a moral framework, but we also lack these really important community structures. And I feel like Buddhism and mindfulness might kind of help one find peace and provide a guiding framework for behaviour, but it doesn't necessarily give you those same kind of community structures. Mm. Do you think that is the case? Is that something that you've thought about, or are you pretty happy just having your communities where they exist elsewhere in your life?
I don't think it need be the case. I think it is. It's difficult to find a sense of community when you're when there aren't that many people who have a strong interest in meditation and secular Buddhism are around. So I'm not part of a community where I live, but I imagine that, you know, in Buddhist countries that you know, meditation centers and temples and can provide a strong sense of community and a strong sense of you know, coming together for a common purpose, and you know, and it seems consistent, and it seems I would love to live near a meditation center or somewhere where they could have talks on to motivate you in your meditation practice and to bring out facets of that into the world and into your world and to support you. And so in my experience, the thing that I have gleaned from it, I think most for me, isn't the community aspect. It is the kind of the having a practice, having a something to work on that infuses my life with meaning. So I guess the obvious comparison is and I think my friends actually made fun of me for this, saying I found a replacement for prayer. that is just that, that's, you know, there's some activity that connects you with something that is a bit more than yourself, and it gives a kind of a path, a framework, a kind of way of thinking about yourself and about different situations that seems to give a bit of that hook of that moral compass, what is good and what is bad.
Do you think there's a part of the Christian experience that it can't replace?
I am not sure. I increasingly I think maybe not. And it's just a feeling. The feeling is the more I read, and the more I practice, and the more I engage and go into meditation retreats, the more deep and the more meaningful it is. And you know, the feeling at the moment is that there's nothing that it couldn't replace. I think it really, I don't know, but my feeling is that it does go quite deep, and there's, I suppose, the having the sense of having a, you know, of being really looked after, of having a, you know, a loving father who wants to give you a big hug, or that is less, that's not, you know, a tenet of you know, that's comes up much in you know, in meditation, mindfulness, secular Buddhism. The way of seeing the universe is perhaps a bit less comforting. But that said, the more I have meditated, the more I do find comfort in just applying the, you know, the advice that it gives. So.
Do you feel concerned that capitalism might crush mindfulness and meditation as sort of movements? I'm just kind of thinking about I read an article today about woke mindfulness and sort of these big mindfulness festivals where lots of rich white people in Lululemon athleisure get together, and it's kind of maybe some people would view it as a kind of corruption of a movement. Does that concern you, or does that just kind of happen and you're very happy just to pursue your own beliefs?
I think that does, that, like, it concerns me a bit that, you know, that the capitalism could, there's different ways of viewing mindfulness, and the way that I came to it was as a form of therapy, and what I found through myself pursuing it further is that, in fact, that at least I can find it to be a deep source of meaning. And I suppose if you know, modern culture can grapple more with those slightly more superficial, you know, help you feel better, help you have less stress, help you, you know, get the job you want or whatever, that it might be a technique to help, then it possibly the public image of it might be tainted. I think there, you know, I would hope that the more thoughtful and less extravagant strand of mindfulness to kind of see it as a quite a simple technique for grappling at what's real and what could be good and what's in the world. I would hope that would remain, and with, you know, with the coming and going of fads of mindfulness, of mixed mindfulness, of what, you know, that you know, it can withstand that. And I suppose, you know, the Buddhism itself has been around for 2,500 years, and it does have quite a lot of, you know, richness and depth that I would hope would
that it's stronger than a sort
than,
of
than a fad. Yeah.
Well, we're running out of time, so we might have to leave it there, and we'll finish with a song. But thanks so much, Patrick, for speaking so openly about your experiences. I think it's been really interesting for me, and I'm sure for the thousands of listeners. And thank you, Isabel, for coming in as well and reading that wonderful public service announcement. But it's also great to have your context as someone who went to university with Patrick.
Yeah.
We will leave it there. This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. You're listening to In Your 20s. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another show, and we will finish off with some Paul Simon.
I met my old lover on the street last night. She seemed so glad to see me, I just smiled. And we talked about some old times, and we drank ourselves some beers. Still crazy after all these years. Oh, still crazy. I'm not the kind of man who tends to socialize. I seem